The Guardian.
Football Weekly is sponsored by Squarespace. Make your next move and create your next website using Squarespace's all-in-one platform. Head to squarespace.com and enter the offer code Football Weekly to get 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain.
Football Weekly, saying, what's the similarity between Arsenal and Akeem Spelunker? They both spend the weekends caving. Elsewhere, that punishing schedule of 9 games in 22 days takes its toll on Man United, with players like poor Marcus Rashford unable to even stand upright. And it's Real Madrid job on hold again for Sam as Palace hand Burnley their first away win, claret sinking Big Sam, as opposed to the other way round this time. With the Black Cats down, we discuss a momentous weekend up and down the Football League, round up the big Euro news and preview the Champions and Europa League semi-finals, Madrid derby, Monaco, Juve, and so much more in this Football Weekly. And on the pod today, we've got your Simon Burnton.
Hello.
And Ian McIntosh.
Hello.
And also Jonathan Wilson.
Hello.
Feels appropriate to have you in, Jonathan. Momentous weekend for Sunderland, of course.
Yeah, I mean, of the 11 relegations we've suffered in my lifetime, I would say this is by some way the least painful.
Right.
I've been pretty numb since, since about 5 years ago. But certainly since September, I think it's been obvious that Sunderland have been going down.
Right, well.
It's a bit like when you have, an elderly relative or an elderly pet and you sort of, you know that, the end is coming. You
might There's a relief there almost, isn't there?
Yeah.
Time to move on.
And at least there was no sort of last-ditch hope. I've heard so much more.
All right. Well, Borough fans might know a little something about that, or maybe not. But we'll talk about the relegation battle later on. I propose that we start with the North London derby. Pochettino with his halftime team talk. Lads, it's Arsenal.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was discussing this with a Tottenham season ticket holding friend of mine last night about... I imagined it must have been as sweet an afternoon as of league football as most Spurs fans have ever witnessed. I mean, to go to a match against Arsenal and on the way there think, you know, we should have these. And then the match pans out and you're better than them throughout. At the end of it, league supremacy is guaranteed. I mean, how sweet must it have felt to be able to... They spent most of the second half singing extremely derogatory songs about Arsenal. Not a care in the world. I mean, there are those matches where you have a 1-0 advantage, but it is slender and you're nervous and you certainly don't start crowing. And they didn't have a 1-0 advantage very long. I mean, they could really relax into this one.
Oh, absolutely. It was their 9th straight win. One of their easiest victories ever in the North London derby. 2-0 the final score, but it could have been much more, as you say. Petr Cech, I think no Arsenal keeper has made more saves in a Premier League game since 2003, was the stat I read. Lloris, by contrast, got his first clean sheet against Arsenal in 11 meetings. And, how many could they have got? St Tottenham's day is thus finally over.
Yeah, and while Tottenham probably aren't going to win the title this season, the very fact that they are so clearly better than Arsenal will almost feel like a title win after, you know, was it 22 years since they finished beneath them? And that was what came off this performance. They were just in a different class. And if we could just spare Arsene Wenger for 1 week, because I think that back three has given them a structure where they don't look so easily overwhelmed. I mean, in fairness, it was more of a back five for most of the time. They were pushed back. There was a structure of sorts there that is kind of more formidable than what they had before. But it's just the players, man for man, with the exception of Petr Cech, really. They weren't at it. Why was Dele Alli the first to react to that rebound?
Well, indeed. 22 years, as you say, that Arsenal finished above Spurs. I love Wenger's quote afterwards. It happened once in 22 years. So, but Dele Alli wasn't even born. He's never been alive in a world in which Spurs were, you know, according to the league table, empirically better at the end of the season than Arsenal.
Yeah, I saw a Spurs fan yesterday saying this is the first time they finished above Arsenal since he's had an email address.
Well, OK, this contention that it's not Arsenal's fault, it's the players.
Well, I mean, on a wider level, it is obviously Arsenal's fault. But just in the performance yesterday, the players... I think Tottenham did have to work for it. I don't think it was easy. They did have to work. But the difference is that Tottenham can work. Mm. Like, as a team, across the board, they can go up a gear and they can get a win out of what might have previously been a frustrating game. I don't see that in Arsenal, particularly in the midfield. They right. just... Wanyama ran the show.
What does Arsene Wenger, and this is a genuine question, what does Arsene Wenger do all day? I mean, because he doesn't take coaching, he doesn't take training, does he?
No, and I think his eye for play has gone as well.
But so, I mean, on a really practical level, what he comes into work in the morning, and then what does he spend the rest of the day doing? I know nobody really knows. You get kind of whispers about the fact, and Raphael Honigstein's big on the fact that German players have said to him, my goodness, this man does nothing. There's no preparation. There's no level of advanced scouting.
Well, those tapes of the under-16 Belgian league don't watch themselves.
But so, I think that's the odd thing, because somebody like Alex Ferguson has a hinterland that he likes his wine, he likes his horses, he's learned to play the piano, learned to speak languages. Wenger, I don't think, does anything apart from football, but you're right, it's very hard to see what he does that's actually useful in football terms these days. So, I mean, the press box at White Hart Lane is in an awful position. You can't really see. I was in the third row, given the first row is given over to paramedics, it's the second row. So that actually means that when the ball's on the far side of the pitch, you can't actually see all the ball because of the camber on the pitch. So it's a terrible view, but you are right next to the dugouts. So there's two things stood out. One was, just as the players came off after warming up, Spurs' players are bigger, and they're really noticeably, obviously bigger. They're taller, they're more muscular, and it looked like one of those games you get in the Sunday League or something, where you have a team of sort of 17-year-olds and then a team of men. And that suggests either Wenger is not buying physically combat enough players, or there's something in their conditioning is not getting them up to the right level. And the other thing was, when Gabriel gave away the penalty, Wenger turned round and very obviously said, I mean, I was lip reading, but I'm pretty sure what he said to the rest of the bench was, he does that every time. Which, to be fair, was what everybody in the press box was saying as well. And I think Gabriel has been slightly protected by the back three, but he's still a dreadful defender. And if you isolate him, he will make mistakes, as he did twice.
Fine.
Both goals were a Gabriel error. And then Wenger himself admitted afterwards, because he very rarely criticises players, and he didn't name anybody. Well, didn't criticise anybody by name, but he was asked if Oxlade-Chamberlain had gone for in the build-up of the first goal, if Oxlade-Chamberlain had gone for the ball with the wrong foot, if it had been just a technical error, and he said sort of, quite justifiably, look, I saw it once, I don't know, but we as a team were very, very slow to react, which is exactly it. The sharpness isn't there either.
Hmm. Didn't look like there was that much fight there.
Well, that's what you were saying, Simon, about this being a very sweet afternoon for Tottenham, I'm sure it was, but at the same time, I wonder if they felt it was slightly anticlimactic. Well, me as a neutral being there...
No, I don't think so.
No, but you sort of want this moment when you end this 22-year curse.
Right.
You want it to be apocalyptic. You want there to be drama. You want to... like when England won the Ashes in 2005 after 19 years, and because it was so tense on that final afternoon at the Oval, it made it all the better. There's no tension here. I mean, I suppose there was a tension in that Spurs didn't score early when they had all those chances. But once they had scored, there's never a chance that Arsenal were coming back into it.
I think that the natural mental makeup of the Tottenham fan is to expect the worst at all terms. I mean, particularly after the Chelsea result previously. I mean, I thought that would, football liking to compound misery upon misery, that Arsenal were just going to pluck a victory from nowhere just to really end the title race.
Especially when Spurs had those misses with Dele Alli and Eriksen
bouncing off the bar when he really should have scored. No, I think they'll be delighted to have absolutely outclassed them.
Well done.
To see off White Hart Lane like that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Spurs fan pointing out the other day, perfect record almost at White Hart Lane, so let's knock it down. Yeah. Well done to Tottenham, who must rank as one of the best sides in the Premier League, not to win the title.
Yeah, I imagine so.
Yeah.
I know the future is the question. Last season they were excellent. This season they have improved again. Next season they need to win the league. The alternative is at some point Pochettino gets poached by another team and maybe there's a decline. They need to finish this. They've been wonderful. Watching Tottenham at home this entire season must have been, a phenomenal experience. They need to win something now.
Right. Okay, well, they're not going to win the title this year. They are still 4 points behind Chelsea, who won at Everton 3-0, which is pretty impressive given Everton's record at Goodison. Chelsea's record against Everton, though, now reads 8 goals scored, none conceded in their 2 meetings. Chelsea now have Borough, West Brom, Watford and Sunderland, and they can afford to lose one of those and still take the title.
Yeah. Yeah, I think this one's pretty much done. And the trip to Everton was clearly the hardest thing left on the itinerary. And so it very nearly proved, because Everton almost opened the scoring in the first 2 minutes. Mm. Calvert-Lewin bouncing one off a post and Romelu Lukaku not quite being able to get to the rebound. But it was a victory, I think, that just encapsulated everything about Chelsea this season and the work Conte's done with them. Everton was stubborn, while probably not anywhere near their best. They were making life difficult. It took a world-class goal from Pedro to break open the doors. And then that was it. You know, the defences were down and off they went. But I thought the best player on the park for Chelsea was Cesar Azpilicueta.
Hmm.
So every time Everton tried to break out of a quick ball, he was there way in advance, as if he'd been told sometime beforehand. He's played at right back and left back and right wing back and left wing back and centre back. And he's so versatile and so clever. And you know, he will not be one of the people remembered sort of 40 years down the line of this team, but he's certainly one of the most important players they've got.
All right, Spanish Dave. Very nice, Ian. All right, well, there's plenty more to talk about, including who else is going to join the Black Cats in their journey downwards and what on earth is going to happen with the top four. We're on to that after this.
Create a beautiful website or online store with an award-winning template from Squarespace. Head to squarespace.com and enter the offer code FOOTBALLWEEKLY to get 10% off your first purchase. Squarespace. Make your next move. Make your next website.
Yeah, Jonathan, 190 consecutive match weeks in the bottom half for Sunderland.
It feels like longer.
We were talking about Spurs' future. What's the picture like for Sunderland? Debt-wise, there's substantial numbers in the minors column. At 150. 150 million, that's what I'm... Yeah?
Yeah, and a wage bill of 83 million.
Right.
Which...
How bad can it get, do you think?
Well, the short one's out. I think the chances of somebody taking Sunderland on in this state is minimal. I mean, obviously, there'll be a huge clear out of the summer. Jermaine Defoe will leave on a free transfer. Kone, well, 10 million for him, 12 maybe. Jordan Pickford, maybe 15, maybe 20 if you're really lucky. So I think maybe raise 30 to 40 million in player sales. We should be able to slash that wage bill. But, you know, what I don't know what comes next.
Right.
Sunderland historically have always bounced back. You know, they've been very good at sort of within 2 or 3 years coming back. But I mean, the problems, you know, it's easy to blame David Moyes. I don't think David Moyes has done anything particularly beneficial this season.
Mm.
But these problems go right back. Yeah. In my entire lifetime, I think Sunderland had one half decent owner, which is Bob Murray, who ended up selling the club because he didn't have enough money to sustain them as a Premier League force. And so, you know, one of the problems you're always going to have is Sunderland is not a wealthy area. And even though they get 40,000, a lot of those are free tickets given to kids or the subsidised tickets. You know, season tickets for under 16s next season are £50. So it's actually cheaper now than when I started going as a 14-year-old in 1990.
Wow.
Which is it's a great idea. Why have the empty stadium? You might as well get the kids in.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of match day revenue, Arsenal make more in 3 games than Sunderland make in a season. So it's very hard financially to compete.
Right.
But these problems go back to when they were last promoted with Roy Keane as manager, when Niall Quinn and Drumcondra were in charge, and they let Keane sign hundreds and hundreds of players on enormous wages. And some of them he'd look at in first training session and think, don't fancy him.
Hmm.
So I mean, Rada Prica, for instance, Swedish striker, who I suspect nobody's ever heard of, yeah, he's brought in for 2.2 million. I'm not even sure he played a game. He said he didn't play more than 2 games and hung around for a couple of years, took his wages and eventually disappeared into, I don't know, the Greek second division or something. And he wasn't the only one. So what's kept on happening is that each owner has tried to trim the squad back, has tried to trim the wage bill because it was preposterous. And then they get in relegation trouble. They sack the manager, which obviously costs money. They then bring in five or six new players. You're in a relegation battle, so you have to pay them a bit more to persuade them to come. And then you know, the cycle begins again the next summer. So, all that was going on. Then Moyes is dealt a horrendous hand in that he had, what, 2 weeks, 3 weeks before the start of the season, no real time to, given he's a dither anyway, no real time to bring in his own players. Also, Yunus Kabul had to go south because of for family reasons. So, you know, he'd been sold fairly cheaply to Watford. Kone decided he wants to move to Everton, so just doesn't play. Yeah, his focus has clearly gone. Kirchhoff was injured. Barini had a long spell out with injury. Pickford had a long spell out with injury. Catamole was out pretty much the whole season with injury. So you had a bad squad ravaged by things beyond Moyes' control. And then he brought this sort of very depressing attitude and this habit of just drifting further and further back in games so that something kept on conceding late goals.
A lot of people making the comparison with the atmosphere under Marco Silva at Hull, who were below Sunderland when Silva arrived there, but have roared out of trouble. They're still 2 points above Swansea, but they got a valuable point away at Southampton. Yeah, Jakupovic saved a late penalty.
Yeah, part of the Saturday afternoon of shame. In that there were four matches, 2-0-0s and 2-1-0s. This became one of the more interesting matches.
Wasn't one of them 2? Burnley was 2.
Burnley was then later. That was the late kickoff.
Oh, later. Sorry, right. Yeah.
Which was a 2-0. Yeah, I mean, Hull got their point. A fine penalty save. You'd have thought that their two home matches will probably see them through, particularly given what happened on Sunday to Swansea, who perhaps didn't get what they might have got.
Right.
Yeah, I think that the biggest difference has been the imagination displayed in transfer policy, that Marco Silva's come in and he's brought in Grosicki and Markovic and the big Italian lad whose name I can never say right, so I'm not even going to try, from Inter.
Which are Ranocchia.
Ranocchia, yeah. That's the one. And there's been positivity there. There's been clearly defined game plans. They've, you know, no one gave him a hope when he turned up. Whereas you look at David Moyes, and I think it's 7 out of 9 of the players he's recruited are players that he's worked with before. And this is
and
a man.
All of them are over 45 years of age.
But this is a man who used to really have a great eye for a player and the balls to actually make daring swoops for people. Like, no one else went for Tim Cahill for what seems now a laughable £1.5 million, but Moyes did. No one else was sure whether Jagielka could cut it, but Moyes was. Seamus Coleman coming in for, 100 grand?
Yeah.
Yeah, Moyes used to make...
Fellaini. He brought Fellaini into the English
game. He did.
Yeah.
But Moyes used to make calls like this, and now he's gone very, very conservative.
Right.
And no, he's not done well. Right. And I'm not sure if the fans will want him to stay.
Hmm. Well, it's a very interesting picture. Swansea just inside the bottom three, just above Borough. We'll talk about their matches shortly. And then above the relegation zone, you've got Palace in 16th. They are only one win away from Saints in 9th. So it's very, very tight there in the middle of the division. Palace, who gave Burnley their first away win this weekend. Well done to Burnley. They move up to 14th, 7 points clear of the drop. Impressive from Sean Dyche. You a fan, Jonathan?
Sean Dyche, yeah, largely. Yeah. Mm.
Good. Thumbs up for Sean Dyche. All right, Stoke got a 0-0 draw with West Ham. Butland was back. Leicester, 1-0 at West Brom. They're now 5 games without scoring a goal. Should we talk, about the situation in the top four? Or was there something else you wanted to
do? I was just going to remark that Leicester are doing... Those of us who said, yes, Leicester will regress, but not that badly. They'll probably finish upper mid-table. Those of us who said that are very, very grateful for Leicester's sudden surge, because the history books will show there wasn't a problem. Yeah, they regressed, but not that far.
Absolutely. Now, top four, Liverpool in action tonight against Watford. At Watford, Simon.
Yes.
Big opportunity for Liverpool to gain a little bit of an advantage in the race for those Champions League spots. Currently, that situation is them, Man City and Man United, all separated by 1 point, all having played 34 matches.
And what rears as a possibility, given that Liverpool are currently level on points with Manchester City, level on goal difference with Manchester City, they've scored 5 more and conceded 5 more. There remains the possibility, and it is good to talk about, and one day it'll happen, of a playoff at the end of the season should the teams finish level on goals scored, goals difference and points. It could happen.
What's the mechanism? But the prior to going to the kind of smash the glass and have a playoff, what are the list of criteria that they judge by?
Points first, yes. Goal difference second, goals yes. scored third.
Right.
Playoff.
So if it was exactly the same number of goals scored and conceded and level on points, you have a playoff.
Yeah.
All right.
There could be a killer Champions League in-out playoff at the end of the season. That possibility is open.
And then City fans could moan about having to travel to Wembley again. And
yeah, that's right.
All right. City, who travelled to Borough, who had the worst home record, I think, in the Premier League, certainly in terms of goals scored, and ended up scraping, is that fair? A 2-2 yeah. draw, City?
Middlesbrough scored 8.33% of all the goals they'd hitherto scored this season against Manchester City on Sunday, which is kind of a damning indictment of City's defence.
They've beaten against City this season, aren't they?
Yes, they are. I was there for the I was there at City for the return leg where they scored in the last minute, thus ruining everything I'd written. I hold grudges.
Right.
But yes, they did. They were a little harshly done to as well, yeah. because the penalty for City's first equaliser looked a little contentious.
Leroy Sané, yeah.
One of many from the weekend.
Well, yeah.
You look at that sort of 3, 4, and 5 in the table and you think, you know, with Chelsea doing so well and they're not in European football, and Leicester doing so well last season when they weren't in European football, and Liverpool doing so well in 2014 and they weren't in European football, yeah, is there some kind of ploy on here? Do they not want to finish up there? Because none of them seem to be acting as if they want it.
Mm. Nobody's told Gabriel Jesus, though, as he leapt in to secure his fourth goal in four games.
What a rapid-fire recovery he's made.
Mm. Quite remarkable.
Very handy, especially given that Aguero seems to be crocked.
Yes. Well, any word on that?
Only dead leg and waiting for scans.
Okay.
That's what I heard. Well, there is some good news, though, because Claudio Bravo's injured as well.
Yes, well, that's really mean, actually. William Caballero playing in this game and conceding two, so
yeah.
it's relative, yeah. I guess.
City's equaliser
yes.
also came from a Sané dive. The second equaliser. So the first was a penalty won by Sané, and the second, he won an extremely weak free kick out on the left wing, holding the ball up with his back to the field of play, waiting for the first tiniest tickle from the vaguest sensation of a breath from a defender behind him and collapsing. He won a free kick, ludicrously, and from there they scored their equaliser. So it wasn't just one Sané dive in my book.
Right.
It was Middlesbrough 2, Sané's diving 2.
Wow. Yeah, nicely put. He went down and it looks like Borough will be 2. They're 6 off safety. Their run-in is Chelsea, Saints and at Liverpool. That doesn't sound easy, does it? Swansea and Hull, by the way, I mentioned the fact that there's 2 points between them. Hull have Sunderland, then they're at Palace, and then they finish at home to Spurs, while Swansea, 2 points behind them, remember, at home to Everton, at Sunderland, and then at home to West Brom. Swansea might get out of this, no?
Well, I think it's a straight fight between Hull and Swansea, isn't it? Mm. I'd be amazed if Middlesbrough... I mean, Middlesbrough would have to take an absolute minimum of... I suppose they could theoretically do it with 2 wins out of the 3 games, but realistically they probably need at least 7 points, which I can't see happening.
Mm. Swansea, let's talk about their clash with Man United. Because, of course, there's lots to say about Man United. They've got that big Thursday game coming up against Celta Vigo in Europa League. A 1-1 draw here, which is the 10th time in their last 15 home games that they've drawn. 7 of those 10 have been 1-1. From a Man United perspective, this result, although it keeps their unbeaten streak alive, I guess it's all about the injuries.
Yes. They no longer have any recognised centre-backs. I think the cupboard is bare.
Okay, so Luke Shaw and Eric Bailly both going out in this game. Jones, Smalling and Rocco already injured. Mourinho afterwards, not quite sure what to make of his comment, "I think Luke Shaw's must be a big injury because to leave the pitch after 10 minutes, I'm expecting a very big injury." Doesn't sound like the détente between the two has lasted very well.
No, not entirely. If I was Luke Shaw, I'd be thinking, you know, escape to victory time.
Right. He'd be busily tunnelling out of the dressing room, I imagine.
Yeah.
And besides, escape to victory, it's the arm.
This is the thing nobody talks about in escape to victory.
Yes.
The goalkeeper... Yep. Who breaks his arm, who's left...
Or has his arm broken.
Has his arm broken by Michael Caine. made a clean break, skipper. He's left in the camp, this heroic man. What happens to him afterwards? I mean, he's in a pretty bad position. So all this sort of, you know, dramatic music, Pelé running through the streets of Paris. Nobody thinks of the poor Irish winger who's been forced to go in goal because Laurie Civil's playing for the Germans.
It's a fair point, Jonathan.
Do you think he ever got out?
I think he probably had a horrible time and was killed.
What if that break went bad? I mean, I can't imagine hygiene was too good, though. It could have gone.
Well, I mean,
gangrenous.
Michael Payne did make the clean break. He was a, you know, he was a very, very proficient arm breaker. John Colby.
I'm seized with an urge to watch
on,
the whole movie again.
Room.
No, yeah, but we'll have to move on from
if
now.
If you do watch it again, sorry, yes. Just one other point. The goal that, I think it's the third goal, where it comes back off the post and is tapped in by Kazimierz Tadena, the Polish player. Mike Somerby gets congratulated for it.
Wrongly?
Well, I mean, one of two things happened here. Right? Either in the script, Mike Somerby was meant to score and it hit the post and Dana knocked it in and they thought, actually, it looks realistic, we'll leave that. Or there was a massive anti-Polish racist element, a real Brexit element among... And Michael Caine did vote to leave.
Yeah.
There was a real sort of Brexit element among the Allies and they thought, yeah, the Polish lad will just ignore him and congratulate the cheery English lad instead.
Lord, I wish we had time to explore this. But, yeah, Swansea, Man United 1-1. And so Man U got big problems at the back. Swansea got big problems staying in the Premier League. I think they can do it. What about that Sigurdsson free kick? Can we spend half an hour talking about that? Because that was delicious.
And a Herrera who knew exactly what was going to happen.
So, okay, let's break this down. So he's there. He sees Sigurdsson shaping up. And he thinks, I know what's up here. He scurries back. You've probably seen the footage here. Takes up a position on the line. And De Gea waves him back forward because...
Well, Llorente started to advance, didn't he?
So him being on the line means Llorente isn't going to be offside.
Going to be offside, yeah. And whoever was standing over the free kick with Sigurdsson sort of made a run down the right side of the wall. And so, yeah, that leads to Herrera deciding, I'll just rejoin the wall.
And right. Sigurdsson's ushering he's telling his players to go and make use of that space that Herrera had gifted them. But even if Herrera had been on the line, the way the free kick went in, even had he been on the line,
you don't think
all he could have
it?
Done is had a really close-up view of a great free kick going into his head.
He could have Suarez'd it over the bar.
He could have Suarez'd it. Yeah, that would have been his option. And the referee would probably not have spotted it. Wave play on.
I think Herrera's cynical enough to try that and be quite happy to try it.
Take one for the team. I mean, there's no question that Swansea absolutely deserved it. Probably the better team in the first half. And very, very unfortunate to go in 1-0 down after one of the dives of a packed weekend of diving action.
Yeah.
In which
probably the dive par excellence, although a lot of people have some love for Kevin Strootman's in the Rome Derby early Sunday morning.
Oh yes, that was a goodie. Fabianski coming sliding out but then withdrawing his hands as he knows he's not going to reach it, and Rashford, I'm going to generously suggest that he thought he was going to get hit, but he dived. He went down with no impact.
There was this dive in Sunday that we had. It's just that every time it's the weaker teams and they already suffer enough, and the likes of Middlesbrough and Swansea and Arsenal having to play strong sides and getting punished by the referees. I thought that the Tottenham penalty was questionable. There was contact, but it was
really?
Very light.
Really? I thought it was absolutely blatant. Kane's running at pace. Gabriel's a huge swing. Any kind of touch, you're going
to
go down.
To me, it looked like a very minor contact on the ankle, and outside the penalty area, free kicks would rarely be given for that. And the other two, there was no doubt. Sane kicks the ball to his left and runs to his right in order to career into the nearest defender. I mean, that was off the charts ludicrous.
I think we complicate this by focusing on the attacking player, not the defensive player. Because the law says it's a foul if you trip or attempt to trip. So given Fabianski withdrew his arms, there is no attempt to trip.
Exactly.
Therefore, it's not a... I mean, I guess if he caught him with his head, it would be...
Mm.
But and again, in the Middlesbrough instance, there's no sort of attempt by him to move towards the attacking player. He hasn't attempted to trip him. He hasn't deliberately put himself in the way. therefore,
yeah, I would say that was almost worse from the referee's point of view in terms of the size of the error, because it was difficult from where Michael Oliver, I think it was, who was officiating the Man United Swansea game, to actually see what had happened between Rashford and Fabianski. And the linesman didn't seem to be in a particularly good place either. But it was clear that Sané was basically edging his way into the defender.
Sorry, was Michael Oliver not at the North London derby?
It was Neil Swarbrick at Manchester United.
Him then, all that above stuff, but with that name. And but video assisted referee?
I mean, I guess so. I'm still, you know, it's one of those things I'm broadly in favour. I'm not quite sure how it would be implemented. So I would want to see a series of models as to how it might be implemented.
When you watch stuff like that, you do want to see the wrong rectified, and that would do it, presumably.
I think that there should be a retrospective action against people who have dived and won penalties. So the referee should be left to make their decision, but if it is conclusively proved on video evidence that there was no contact and that there was a dive,
but that punishes,
the player should be...
That punishes the culprit, but not the victim. The victim doesn't get the points retributed where the penalty has cost
them. That is true, but I do think that that it would... if a player knows that, should it be proven that they dive, they would receive a too-much ban, say...
In the long run, it would stop. They'll stop their nonsense.
Yeah, I mean, that's just how any judicial system works, right? That if I kill Simon... I'm not planning to, don't worry. But I guess I'd say I wasn't. So anyway.
Yeah, there's very little the law courts can do.
You can't be brought back to life, but I can be locked up.
No, that's true. But there is, you know, damages. Where Simon's still alive to receive some form of damages, you would be, I think, legally eligible to sue for compensation, though, from...
If I'm killed?
No, I'm suggesting if you're still alive.
Oh, okay.
All right. Listeners, we'll move on, as you probably already have. because Man United, then... with their banged-up squad, have to face the mighty Galicians of Celta Vigo in Thursday's Europa League semi-final.
Yes.
How much... Who's seen some Celta Vigo this year?
Tiny amount.
Oh, good, that's enough. No, because people say they're a Spanish side that's not very Spanish, as befits their kind of geographical location.
Well, Eduardo Berizzo, the coach, is very much a Bielcista. Ah. So they play very hard-pressing, very high line. I guess you hope it's a game that maybe not in terms of outcome, but at least in terms of the type of game it is, a bit like when United played Athletic, Bielsa Athletic. How long ago was that? 3 years, 4 years ago? Because they were two great games. Mm. United obviously would rather have a different result, but if it's a game of that nature... then that'd be very good to watch.
Yeah, no, Ibrahimovic, obviously. Sorry.
Celta have sort of given up on the league, so it's very hard to judge what kind of form they're in. They're playing kids in the league, so yeah, they played a whole load of sort of 19, 20, 21-year-olds when they beat Granada.
Hmm.
And then did they end up, another 1-0 down, they end up losing to Athletic.
3-0.
Right.
But they've got an interesting record this year. They've beaten Barcelona, for example.
Mm-hmm. Was that the 4-3 game?
Yeah, that's right, back in October, although Barcelona did trump 5-0 when they met again.
Higher strategy, yes, that's always the case with a high press like that.
That's true. But anyway, so you've got Iago Aspas, who's having a terrific time there, late of Liverpool. And Pione Sisto, who Man United fans will remember, because he used to play for Midtjylland and indeed scored in both legs against Man United for Midtjylland when they met in Europe last year. As well as they've got John Guidetti. Ex of Man
City.
So it's like a derby for him. I'll be fired up for that. But seriously, Man United, who were very much and probably still are the favourites for this tournament, with the injury list that they've got, that's a tough game for them.
Yeah, I don't think you can have realistic expectations of a team with no centre-backs. If they get through, well done to them. If they don't, I don't think it should be used as a stick to beat them with. They're in a practically impossible situation now. But... you know, whatever happens, they've won a cup. They're probably going to be top six. It's a transitional season. It's not one to cast any Mourinho is finished, sack him now kind of judgments, I don't think.
Right, okay. I think it's a really good Ajax side as well.
Good, because they're playing on the Wednesday because of Dutch Remembrance Day and taking on Lyon, who people were very excited about, but they've gone a little bit hot and cold of late. Have Leon. Also, Alexandre Lacazette, their big weapon, is in some doubt because he picked up an injury in the previous round against Besiktas. But just tell us why you love this Ajax so much.
It's a proper Ajax team. You know, it's kind of loads of kids. Patrick Kluivert's son's in the side. But they play with... I think particularly it was the first leg of the quarter-final. Yeah, they just played with such pace. It was, you know, a proper. So what you remember Ajax teams from the 90s. So I think people, you know, Ajax fans would say this is probably the best Ajax generation since that side of I think it's 2003-04, which I remember very fondly. I happened to be in Amsterdam, went to a game in Feyenoord, and it was just a ridiculous team. They had Mito and Zlatan up front. You had Tomasz Galaszek at the back of midfield, Van der Vaart, Van der Meijden, Pienaar, Schneider. One of those must have come off the bench. You can't have played all of those together, surely. Maxwell at fullback. Just a ridiculously good side. And you know, this appears to be the first sort of genuine heir to that. Which, I mean, you'd have to talk to somebody who knows more about it than I do. But I wonder if this is Cruyff's revolution. You know, when he took over the club, what was it, seven years ago? And the sort of the youth policies that he put in place, whether this is the fruit of that.
Right. Well, we'll dial up that Mikko Jongsma. If they get through.
And the Dutch are desperately in need of new players at a national level, so it's probably come just in time.
Well, they must be favoured. They looked terrific against Schalke in both legs. 2-0 the first leg. The second leg, they went 2-0 down, but then roared back in extra time. And at home, they've won all six of their matches in the Europa League. They've kept clean sheets in five of them. So,
but they did lose to PSV, so will not win the league.
Is that right?
I think that's right. I think they lose to PSV last week, I think.
Okay. Feyenoord pretty much nailed on for that.
Okay, right.
Mm. That's right, Simon, they are, says producer Ben. Let's take a little break, and then we'll be back with one or two other things, including Ian's trip to Leighton Orient and other European business and that kind of thing. Ian and Jonathan, you've just come back from Dublin. When I say just come back, it might have been a while ago.
That was last Monday.
Oh, well, there you go. Yeah. How was that? You
do? Great. Yeah.
A blizzard do.
Yeah. Always a very generous crowd in Dublin. You know, they not. I mean, they don't give us money, but they do laugh quite.
They do in a sense,
readily.
Though. Don't
well, they
do.
They pay for tickets, I suppose. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's. I think it's the fifth time we've done Dublin
really
with Blizzard, and yeah, it's always. It's always a good event.
Okay.
So,
what was the most interesting thing that you'd learnt, Ian, that night? Because who else was there? There was lots, you know, there was football intelligentsia.
When Ian was there.
Yeah. I was very much
who
not.
Who else was there? Was
not
that
Ian's intelligentsia? I was pretty much there for knob gags.
You know. Okay.
Philippe was there and Owen McDavid from Second Captains was there.
Brilliant. All right. Fantastic.
Were you also playing the National Stadium?
No, we can't stretch to that. We're in the Sugar Club.
Sugar Club, which is a lovely venue, you know, for the smaller act. you're right, though, Simon. We will be in the National Mega Arena Dome on the June the 7th, I'm thinking. TheGuardian.com/footballweekly. I believe there's one or two still upper tier. Very much rosé, but, you know, the further away you are, the better, some would say.
The front row does get wet.
Yeah. And on that note, what do you fancy talking about now? Football League ups and downs, Champions League semis, or this person, Mac Phil Carver, asking which three Premier League stadiums have the worst atmosphere and what would you do to improve them? Simon? Ian? Jonathan?
Anfield during the day, not at night.
Okay.
That can be very quiet.
So like an afternoon game at Anfield?
Yeah. I can't recall a particularly noisy one that I've been to.
Right.
The Emirates, certainly. I don't know.
I don't disagree with the Emirates, I don't disagree, but you do wonder what it would be like if Arsenal were actually winning stuff. I mean, you know, it's the sort of thing, you know, the Stadium of Light is, for me, is nothing like as good as Wrigley Park was.
Hmm.
But then things like I wasn't at the Chelsea game last season, but mates of mine who were there, and then I was at the Everton game, which was the midweek, I think it was the Wednesday of the Tuesday night after that Chelsea game. That was a phenomenal atmosphere, you know. I think you judge an atmosphere on the silence.
Okay.
You know, when everybody is sort of singing the same song, you get the silence at the end of the line, and that silence has a real sort of poignancy and a real sort of emotive value. And that win over Everton, that 3-0 win, the penultimate game of the season, the guaranteed Sunderland stayed up, that was, you know, a sensational atmosphere. But the Stadium of Light can be pretty flat.
Okay.
But you can't really blame people this season if it's flat, can you? I mean,
the answer to the question being safe standing.
Yeah. I wondered if
some good form. So,
Or just teams who play exciting football and don't.
But it's the Premier League, man.
And also,
it's the home of
toning down the. People can't sing.
Yes.
if they're being subjected to the latest Ed Sheeran smash at ridiculous ear-splitting volume before kickoff.
Well, that's Ed Sheeran really off the playlist and safe standing.
My experience of going to games as a fan in the early 90s, the best atmospheres, the loudest it was sort of a 10, 15 minutes before kickoff or immediately after some kind of game-changing goal. But the 10, 15 minutes before kickoff, because when the game starts, people actually do want to watch the game.
Hmm.
But 10, 15 minutes before kickoff, if you've got something being blasted at you, to start with, people just don't even turn up till kickoff because they hate that so much. They stand on the concourse having their beers. So.
Wembley's probably the worst for that. The music's so loud, you can't even talk to the person sat next to you. And then you've got the announcer who comes on and just roars at ear-splitting volume.
Well, pitch announcers I'd get rid of. I'm sure there's a couple of them who aren't complete fools, but they're few and far between.
We're still missing a place on our three worst Premier League stadiums. What about London Stadium?
Oh, yeah, that's awful.
Okay,
yeah,
there
yeah.
you go.
That's tough, actually. Yeah, good point.
Yeah. Matt Phil Carver, there you go. Do send your questions in. I can only apologise because I forgot to look at the message boards this week. So if you put something really good there, I'm not ignoring it. I just didn't see it. Send it in again.
Also, you could probably add another three comfortably to that list.
Oh, really?
I know there's going to be backlash for that, but
certainly
people going, what about Old Trafford?
Right.
Yes, entirely valid point.
Okay.
Now, but, I mean, there's a paradox there as well, isn't there? That you get at bigger clubs, you get a load of tourists.
Yeah.
Tourists go for the atmosphere, but by being there, kill the atmosphere.
Mm.
And that's a very hard balance to strike.
Right. OK, well, a very special Champions League preview coming up because there's sizzling semi-finals. Itching to talk about those. But first, tell us the news from the Championship.
OK, in the Championship, the playoffs are all sewn up.
Hmm.
Leeds have missed out. And
is that mathematically?
Well, there is a goal difference of 10 between them and Fulham, and Fulham in fantastic form. They could theoretically turn that around on the final day of the season, but they won't.
So you've got Reading, Sheffield Wednesday, Huddersfield and Fulham.
Yes.
Right.
Huddersfield's form is bad, and they did lose at the weekend at Birmingham, but only after making 10 changes to their team. They're thinking about the playoffs already. That match was really important at the bottom. Wigan went down as a result of the weekend action, and Blackburn, Nottingham Forest and Birmingham, it's all very poised down there. Those 3 points, really important for Birmingham.
Right. Wow, that's big, isn't it? In League One, Ian.
Mm, yes. Well, congratulations, first of all, to Bolton,
okay.
who secured their return to the second flight.
Sheffield United got their 100 points as well.
They did, and well done to them, and well done to Millwall as well. The final playoff place was between Millwall and Southend. Southend just had to better Millwall's result. The Shrimpers held up their side of the deal by beating Bury 1-0. Millwall were, I think, 2-0 up and 3-1 up before suddenly Bristol Rovers came back and made it 3-3, putting Phil Brown into playoff contention, and then Millwall scored in the dying moments.
Oh, you're not so sorry.
But it's okay. A seventh place for a basket case team like Southend is actually very good.
All right. Shrimpers basket case.
Very nice.
Yeah.
Phil Brown was singing again.
Oh, what was he? What did he sing this time?
The end of season gala.
Yep.
There was a chorus of "Sweet Caroline" by the Southend squad, led by Phil Brown.
Oh, so that's nice.
He is still singing.
Okay. Port Vale. But that's the thing, is there's always someone worse off, isn't there? I mean, for every Man United banged up, there's an Arsenal. For every Arsenal out of the top four, there's a Sunderland. And then there's Leighton Orient.
Oh,
there's nobody worse off.
Is there Leighton Orient, yeah.
Okay, so we move down to League Two, where Plymouth are the champions. Donny and Portsmouth are up. And Blackpool...
They've still got a game to go.
Oh, have they?
So Plymouth leapfrogged into the top spot at the weekend, but they are not champions yet.
Oh, okay. My apologies. Blackpool squeezing into the playoffs, it looks like, but Hartlepool going down along with Leighton Orient. You went along to see what was, I assume, their final home game, was it?
Yeah, the final home game at what we traditionally call Brisbane Road.
Right. You do seek this kind of thing out, don't you?
Or does it seek me out? I don't know.
Mm.
Bad things seem to happen.
It didn't move to you. In this case, Mohammed definitely went to the mountain.
Fair point, well argued.
All right, it turned out to be quite a momentous match.
Yeah, I was there a few hours beforehand because there was a demonstration in nearby Coronation Gardens, which attracted about 750 people, very funereal atmosphere. It was a number of speakers, supporters and local MPs making it clear that they want Piketty out. And that the club will not die, but the club may actually die.
Hmm.
I'm sure everyone knows the backstory now. I probably don't need to repeat it. This was their last home game, and they're up against Colchester, who are still in with a shout of the playoffs. And at that demonstration, it was funereal, it was sad, but you could sense the kind of simmering anger, and you knew something was going to happen at some point. And speaking to Leighton Orient fans afterwards, they were always going to end up on the pitch. They just didn't expect to end up on the pitch 5 minutes before the end, with Colchester winning 3-1. But on came a red smoke bomb. Up went the smoke. A few young lads ran on, then a few more, and then everyone just thought, oh, come on then, let's go. And they just piled onto the pitch, and after the customary, you know, forward rolls and skids and that you have to do, assembled in front of the director's box, such as it is, given that there are hardly any directors ever in there, and started roaring in no uncertain terms for Bichetti to leave the club as soon as possible. They registered their feelings of abandonment towards the EFL in equally colourful tones. And then steadfastly refused to leave, despite the best efforts of everyone, from stewards to police to coaching staff. Omar Reza came onto the pitch, and he wasn't successful in coaxing them back to the stands, but they did sing Omar Reza, he's a geezer, with an extra word included there. So that was nice. At one point, the Orient fans did leave the director's box area of the pitch to head over to the Colchester fans, where they exchanged applause and then joined each other in a song of Stand Up If You Hate Southend.
How long did this all go on for?
Over an hour and a half.
Wow.
There was no way of getting them off, and so the announcement finally was made, match abandoned.
Right.
And so everyone cleared. But as we were all sort of finishing up our articles, we noticed something very strange.
Mm.
A team of stewards and coaching staff and basically anyone who was still down there came running on to start clearing the pitch of litter. And then a couple of groundsmen came down and started undoing the nets and bringing them back down. He thought, my God, they're not going to...
They did, didn't they?
They really did. The game restarted 2 hours after the first pitch invader.
They told the fans it was basically suspended, let them get out of the ground and then finish it off.
And then sneakily came back on for 5 minutes of keep ball. The two things have to be said. One is that the protest was almost entirely good-natured. I mean, there was an old lady in a mobility scooter on the pitch at one point, so there was never any threat of violence. The EFL said afterwards that they had to pull this little stunt because the integrity of the league had to be protected. But the 5 minutes of football that came afterwards, I posted some on Twitter, it was like that bit in The Simpsons. And the ball was just being passed up and down the pitch. No one was playing football. They were just using up the time. So I'm not sure how much integrity there was there. But the serious concern is that the next time there's a pitch invasion and the next time they try to abandon a game, will anyone actually leave? It's a worrying precedent they've set there.
It's like a child crying wolf.
Well, quite.
That's the analogy I would make. Right. Well, on that worrying note, we stop briefly and then we return with bang. Some of the biggest matches this weekend or perhaps even this season, and we've only gone and left them till last. I'm talking about Real Madrid's clash with Atletico Madrid. What a delight to finally see these two giants of the Spanish game coming face to face.
For only the fourth consecutive season.
Is this one going to be different, Jonathan?
Well, I think what's inexplicable, actually, is that in the last four seasons, they've met 8 times in the league and Atletico have lost once. And yet Real Madrid have come out on all three occasions in the Champions League.
In Europe, yeah.
So is that, I don't know, is that coincidence? Do Real Madrid have some kind of psychological edge in Europe because of the respective history with Atletico in Europe? I don't know. But I mean, this seems... I think both Champions League semi-finals are games between... Games where if it's high scoring, you can tell which team will win. If it's low scoring, you can tell which team should win.
Right.
So if it's high scoring, you'd expect Real Madrid and Monaco to go through. If it's low scoring, you'd expect Juve and Atletico to go through. Real Madrid have scored in 58 successive games.
Wow.
They've kept one clean sheet in the last 16. Atletico have conceded only 15 goals in the last 14 games, in which
good
they've
numbers.
Lost only once.
They had a 1-1 draw at the Bernabeu, where they're going to be playing this first leg a few weeks back in the Liga. But as you point out, in Europe, it seems to be a slightly different thing.
And they've got a huge problem with no right-backs.
Right.
Because Juan Fran, Jimenez and Rosalico are all out.
Right. Also, Yannick Carrasco's out. Diego Godin, I believe, is not going to be available. One or two absences, including Gareth Bale, which may or may not be consequential for Real Madrid, who had big 6-3 aggregate scoreline against Bayern Munich in their quarterfinal, but maybe a little bit fortunate with a number of offside goals and questionable decisions there. Equally, Atleti, did they kind of dodge a bullet there at the King Power in their second leg? I don't know. Who do you think? They're a team that can hit you hard on the break with Griezmann, and Real Madrid are a bit shaky at the back. Are you willing to suggest that they might do?
I think they should.
Away? Yeah?
I mean, I know there's a 10-point gap in the league and Atletico have played a game more, but I just think Simeone is a much, much better coach than Zidane. I think in the last 16 games, Real Madrid have gone behind 9 times and lost only twice. So that shows great spirit. They can come back. And obviously they've got great players. But it also suggests they can't control a game. Now, if Simeone can get control, then Atletico should be able to take advantage. Apparently, and I think the last 14 game spell, they've lost only once.
Yeah.
They have, I'd argue, in that 14 game spell, probably that's the best football any team in Spain has played for a protracted period this season.
You're talking about Real?
No, Atletico.
Oh, Atletico, sorry.
Okay. I think Real Madrid and Barcelona, they've both scored far more goals than Atletico. They play this weird, haphazard, not particularly intelligent football this season.
Okay. Atletico coming off their biggest win since November. They beat Las Palmas 5-0 away at the weekend. If this were to go badly for Real, and remember the second leg is going to be the second last game, the penultimate game ever played at the Calderon, so that's going to be quite an atmosphere that night. If it all goes wrong, the suggestion is that Zidane slinging his hook. Right.
And I know this sounds academic, but if Real Madrid did become the first side to defend Champions League, they're not the best side. You know, you want that team who does that to be a truly great side. You want the coach who achieves that to be a truly great coach.
Mm.
I think the Real Madrid side that won the Champions League last season is the worst Real Madrid side ever to win a Champions League.
Really?
Yeah.
Like worse than that Chelsea side?
No, worst Real Madrid side.
Oh, sorry, right, okay.
So of their 11, I think that's the poorest side to win it.
Okay.
And I think this side is worse.
They haven't convinced you yet, but if they do get past Atletico and then they do beat whoever they meet in the final, then maybe they will deserve it, eh?
Well, they certainly deserve it more than last season when they had an absolutely facile draw.
Mm. What do you think about Monaco-Juve then? Attacking v defending, which is better? Finally, Simon, we're going to get an answer to that question.
perhaps. I mean, Monaco have been fantastic this season. Of the two semi-finals, one we've seen for the last three years, and is between teams that meet each other frequently. Monaco are they are emerging this season. They have emerged. I don't know how brief their flowering will be. I think the latest rumours that just a couple of players will go. Big players leaving to big clubs. So, you know, Monaco are this precious, fragile flower full of youthful exuberance, flourishing in spring,
right?
Up against the old lady and...
grim.
Well, and more knowing wiles. I don't know. I think this is the fascinating one.
It is, though, isn't it? 146 goals, I think, is the number of times that Monaco, 146 number of goals they've scored, which is crazy. But then again, you've got Juve, who shut Barcelona down. And Gigi Buffon apparently doing some wild backtracking. Supposedly, he'd said before the Barcelona games, if I get 2 clean sheets against Barcelona, I'll retire. Yeah. I mean, I think he was just saying, like, wow, it would be amazing. And then that's exactly what they did. Juve have only conceded 2 goals in their 10 Champions League matches so far. It shouldn't be forgotten that they have also scored 17, and they did put 3 past Barca in the opening leg. I mean, they would be the more complete team of the two.
Yeah, but Monaco always score 3. Whenever I look at their score, they've always scored 3. I just looked at them now, they scored 3 at the weekend.
3 in their last 4 Champions League games.
And the remarkable thing about Monaco is that they tried to do it the kind of brash lottery winner way by going out and splashing money about and looking for resale value and throwing muscle around. And then Ribolov's divorce came in and that ended that one. And now they've had to cut their cloth accordingly. They've had to do things properly and they're a much better team.
Yeah.
And I think that, as Jonathan was alluding to Ajax earlier, there's a kind of, for the first time in ages, that feeling of, as you so eloquently put it, the flowering of this young team all at the same time. You kind of want them to stay together for a bit.
That would be lovely, wouldn't it?
You certainly want what they've done to be recognised at the very least with a place in the final.
Do you? Well, I'm not sure
As a neutral, I do.
Do you? I think a lot of people must feel that way. It's a fascinating clash, isn't it? That's happening. What day is happening on Wednesday?
Sidibe and Bakayoko might both be out for Monaco, and Falcao's out as well, I think, which is less consequential. But
Bakayoko,
yeah, I mean, he missed the second game against City, I think, through suspension, and he didn't seem to miss him that night. But yeah, his partnership with Fabinho in the middle, I think, is crucial to them.
Just to counter my pro
Sammy
Monaco.
Sammy Kadira
suspended,
for Juve. Yeah.
Just to counter my pro Monaco
facile
observations with some facile observations about Juventus, it would be nice to see them do something, if for no other reason than to fight against the perception of them when they last made the final as the underdogs and as some kind of plucky upstarts that got in with the big luck.
I mean, that wasn't completely wrong, given the... I know history-wise, no question, they are one of the grandest teams around, but I think it was actually fair and probably reflected in the final scoreline as well.
Well, on a very relative level, but I mean, it was more like, you know, the betting memes and the social media.
Oh, yeah.
But
it's reflective of the ridiculous economic modern football now has. It wasn't reflective of Juventus. It was,
well, I took it to be reflective of Juventus.
Well, anyway, she'll have a chance to perhaps
restore her honour.
That good. Okay, Monaco, by the way, are set fair to win the French title after Sunday night's clash between Nice and Paris Saint-Germain. Ian, you're smiling. It must be because of Mario Balotelli.
Mario Balotelli. Or
maybe
around
it's because of Blaise Matuidi
barreling 60 yards to go and
so,
knock him over.
Fine opening goal from Balotelli, who because PSG turning up, and they were level on points with Monaco until the weekend. Monaco then won at Toulouse, and Balotelli opens the scoring with a fine goal and then does some lovely Lord of the Dance jiggery pokery up a wing in front of a bemused PSG defender. And Blaise Matuidi waits about 10 seconds and thinks, I've had enough of this.
There was a League Cup final, I think it was about 2006, Man United against Wigan, and a very young Ronaldo started juggling the ball with Man United 4-0 up, and he was juggling the ball after about an hour in the centre circle, and at least three Wigan players did the same thing, just converging on him. And it was very reminiscent of that. But what was even more amusing was the PSG chairman, whose name escapes me for now, but who can always be relied upon to completely lose everything when PSG fall short. There was a magnificent picture of him when they were knocked out of Europe by Chelsea a few years ago, just looking like the raging boy who didn't get the Christmas present he wanted. And he's come out afterwards and said, there will be changes.
Right.
It's like, but there's always changes.
Well, a 3-1 loss and two players sent off for PSG, who are still on for a double with the Cups and might still, you know, it's not mathematically Monaco's yet, but it does look like being theirs. Bayern Munich, though, have sealed their 26th German title and their fifth in a row. We talked about last week how they'd gone five games without a win for the first time since mid-90s. But they certainly got a win this weekend when they went to Wolfsburg and beat them 6-0. Wolfsburg in a world of pain down the bottom end of things. All right. That, unless anybody wants to talk about Lazio's remarkable win in the Rome derby, which leaves with Napoli's win away at Inter on Sunday night, just 1 point between Roma and Napoli in the race for second place. Juve all but sealed the title. That is that for this edition, this bank holiday edition of Football Weekly. Simon, you off to see what?
Vicarage Road tonight?
Yeah.
For sure, I'll be
okay.
there.
Okay. To explore the necessity for the D in Watford.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
Well, oh,
yeah.
Boo!
Ian, what does the week hold for you?
It's the final of the BetBright Football Manager Cup.
No
set
way.
Set pieces are hosting. We have been to...
How many players are left?
Just four. We've been to Leeds, Manchester, London and Glasgow for 16-team competitions. We've taken one winner from each.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Now they're all meeting in the grand final to play for £5,000.
Jeepers, they're going to get... The winner gets £5,000.
Yeah.
£5,000.
Straight knockout. So two people will play one game of Football Manager with £5,000 sat in the middle.
Damn. Yes. Are you going to put the cash on the table right in front of them?
I think we might have a novelty oversized check, and we might dangle it, you know, from the roof above them and just lower it within reach.
I was there at the Manchester event on Wednesday, and it was tremendous fun. And if Vladi won it on last Wednesday, doesn't win, then it'll be somebody very, very good who wins.
Did all right, didn't he?
What happened when the Sims going on? Is it all going out on a big screen?
Yeah. Right. And you have a big screen, which has led to the weirdest thing I've seen in a very weird season. It was a very crowded pub in London, a big screen with a Football Manager game in 2D mode, so it's just coloured dots.
Like Sensible Soccer type thing?
No, even more stripped down, just literally coloured circles moving across a green background to signify the action. And one of the yellow dots gave the ball away, and the man behind me went, "Oh, no, you don't want to do that!" And I was like, wow, he's really into that yellow dot.
In the future, the men in the pub will be replaced by yellow dots as well. We'll have the perfect evening. That's fascinating. And where's this going to be, the final?
This will be in the offices of Totally Communications.
Oh, right, so it's not open to the general public.
No, not this one.
All right.
But you can watch the live stream. The whole thing will be online, so keep following the set pieces and you'll get the link for that.
God, there's always a catch, isn't there? All right.
Not this one, but maybe in the future.
Okay. Jonathan, for any stragglers, we're still with us. What have you got planned? Anything exciting? More cricket?
I think I'll have a dawn net tomorrow to try and get my length right.
Okay.
Because that was a problem on Saturday, though I batted. My bowling was rather less useful. Uh-huh. And then I'm off to Wiltshire on Friday to play games at Chilmark on Friday night and Fonthill on Saturday.
Bang. Well, that's it then. Well done, listeners. We'll be back on Thursday if you want some more. Many thanks in the meanwhile to Jonathan Wilson.
Thank you.
To Ben Green, to Ian McIntosh, and to Simon Burton, and you, listener. Have a great week. See you soon.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.